Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. To what extent does one's race determine one's destiny in American society? While we've come a long way toward eliminating explicitly racist laws and policies, Black Americans as a group continue to suffer the effects of inequitable school funding, criminal justice stereotyping and harsher sentencing, housing isolation, and economic hardship. So why do so many of the promises of the civil rights movement remain unfulfilled, and what will it take to bring them to fruition for every American, regardless of race? F. Michael Higginbotham is Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. His new book is called Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to have an opportunity to speak to your listeners today about clearly what is a very important issue in America today, and that's racial equality.
Start, if you would, you say, ending racism in post-racial America. Some people assume that if we have one, we can't possibly have the other.
Well, the problem is we've made a great deal of progress. We've ended slavery. We've ended Jim Crow segregation. We've passed anti-discrimination legislation. We have implemented affirmative action, and we've even elected our first Black president. But progress does not mean post-racial. Progress does not mean that race is no longer a significant factor in opportunities or in hardships that people endure in our society today.
So talk about the extent to which the history of codified discrimination in America is relevant to understanding the issues that contribute to inequality even after the elimination of most of those laws.
Well, Chris, we have tremendous disparities today in the socioeconomic index, whether it be wealth accumulation, unemployment, income, mortality rates, graduation rates. There are huge disparities in terms of race between white and racial minorities, between white and Black. And those disparities have been with us even during slavery and Jim Crow times, and they continue to exist today. A lot of people have various explanations for these disparities today, because during Jim Crow, it was very simple. Jim Crow laws and practices mandated such disparities. But today, there are various theories. Some say that it's Black intellectual deficiency. Others say that it's political ineptness of Black politicians. Others say that it is Black irresponsibility that causes these disparities today. But in my book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, I basically explain the disparities by a racial model that was created during slavery times and, despite our progress, continues to exist today. And there are three aspects to that racial model. One is racial hierarchy, and that is white beliefs in superiority and in Black inferiority. The second aspect is racial exclusivity. And that includes both white and Black desires for isolation, as well as white desires for Black separation. And then the third aspect is racial victimization. And that includes both external victimization of Blacks, as well as internal victimization of Blacks by Blacks themselves. So you have this model, these three aspects that, despite our progress, continue to exist today. And for me, that explains why we have these disparities. And as long as this model continues, as long as we do not shatter this model, those disparities will not go away and will never reach a post-racial America.
Do you think it's actually harder, Michael, to get to that next step of an America free of racism, given that the situation today may be better than it was in the Jim Crow era, but the low-hanging fruit is gone and things are so complex these days?
I think you're correct, Chris. I think it is harder to get to that next step. Clearly, you know, we have made progress, and some of the things we have done have not been that easy to get to. But it's still going to be very difficult to get to a post-racial America. And the reason for that is, while we have eliminated laws on the books that mandated discriminatory treatment, that mandated inequality, we still haven't changed the hearts and minds of many Americans. And this is what The Ghosts of Jim Crow, my book, talks about, how we still think in a certain way that is very similar to how we thought during Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. So while we're no longer required to be separate in housing or required to be separate in schools, the way we think, we continue to live in areas by choice that are segregated de facto. We continue to go to schools that are segregated de facto because we're making choices based upon our thinking process that reflects this racial model that existed during Jim Crow and continues today.
Yeah, so the Jim Crow laws sent a message discouraging any interracial socialization, and ultimately what's happened is that those attitudes persist into the 21st century, and notably even among people who don't necessarily believe themselves to harbor animosity toward people of other races.
I think that's well said. A lot of the choices that we make today, they're not even conscious choices. We have a certain thinking that that black is still inferior, that black is bad, and as a result of that thinking, whether it be conscious or unconscious, we make certain decisions based upon that thinking.
Let's talk a little bit about this idea of internal victimization. I think it is disgraceful but sort of understandable that white Americans have for a long time, a certain segment of the population has believed whites to be superior. How has that sort of translated to attitudes within certain segments of the black population in America?
Well, I think that's very important to bring up because we have all been harmed by this racial model. We've all been harmed by the racism that has existed in America. In Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court said the problem with segregation is how it makes blacks feel. When they're segregated out, it makes them feel inferior. And so they have a psyche problem, a psychological problem because of this segregation. What the Supreme Court failed to address was the other classroom, how our notion of segregation and racism impacts whites as well, so that it causes whites to feel superior and it causes blacks to feel inferior. And the Supreme Court recognized that aspect of causing blacks to feel inferior, but we don't want to lose sight that we've all been impacted. And so this notion of white superiority has been pushed on us from the law and practices, as well as the notion of black inferiority. And so blacks have clearly been impacted, have clearly been affected by this. And it's not that only whites have these notions. Blacks have these notions too. And it impacts how blacks behave in our society as well as how whites behave.
So today, African Americans are twice as likely as European Americans to be poor, to be homeless, to be unemployed, or to be incarcerated. Talk about how education inequities play into all of these problems.
You know, what's really sad is that if you look at the inequities in education, which is such an important vehicle for upward mobility in our society. I mean, so many stories we hear about today of successful folks having gone through the education system, having worked hard, having benefited, and have clearly changed the dynamics of their life, have clearly created opportunities for themselves. So education is, in my view, the best vehicle for upward mobility in our society. The problem today, though, is that if you look at where we were during Jim Crow, our schools are still almost as segregated as they were during Jim Crow. And so if you look at most blacks go to segregated schools, which of course are also impoverished schools for the most part. So you have this economic racial dynamic that prevents a lot of people from taking advantage of this legitimate vehicle for upward mobility. So in terms of education, while we say we have made tremendous progress, we still are as segregated almost as we were during the Jim Crow days, and most of those segregated schools are schools that aren't economically advantaged.
I think you mentioned earlier that there is a persistent attitude among some Americans that somehow Black Americans are intellectually, academically inferior. Let's talk about the history of that, particularly rooted in the time of slavery when it was quite literally illegal to educate people who had been kept in slavery.
It was indeed. Most states had laws that slaves couldn't be taught to read or write. A number of those states actually also had laws that blacks could not be taught to read or write.
Even free blacks.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was a crime to do that as well. And so education, I mean, the reason why this was done was not only to prevent slaves from being able to take advantage of opportunities to run away, so that how education might assist them in being able to forge documents or to manipulate the system. So education was used, one, to keep slaves in a subservient position. But the second aspect, education was prevented to slaves so that they, in fact, would feel inferior and feel that they were in a position that was justified based upon the fact that they weren't educated.
So talk about why we've struggled so much in this country to just fix the issue of funding inequities in education across every racial line. It would seem so simple to just declare that this amount of money goes to this amount, to this student. But we've been unable to do that.
You know, it's very unfair. During Jim Crow, most states spent $10 on every white student and $1 on every black student. Hmm. And many states said, well, that was substantially equal. It's not totally equal, but it's substantially equal, and that's okay under our notion of equality under the American Constitution. But if you look at today, even though we've eliminated Jim Crow in education, if you look at the schools that are predominantly black and the money that is spent on those schools, you still have a significant disparity. And so that is a result of our funding setup for public schools. And most of our public schools are funded through property taxes. And based upon living in a wealthy community, you're going to have much more money for public education than you do in an impoverished community. And so when you look at the disparities and you look at the predominantly black institutions, there's tremendous economic disparity in our funding still today. It's not done, of course, simply on the basis of Jim Crow racial divisions, but there's still a significant disproportionate impact on black education.
Not to mention the fact that wealthier parents are in a position to raise additional money above and beyond whatever tax money pays for that school.
We haven't even raised that, and of course that's true as well.
Mm-hmm. My guest is F. Michael Higginbotham. He's Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. We're talking this hour about his new book. It's called Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we do have telephone lines open now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is F. Michael Higginbotham, Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and author of the new book Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So you mentioned earlier, Michael, that obviously education can be a great route to economic mobility. We still have problems with getting equitable education financing across all the races in this country. And then you have the recession, which took a particularly heavy toll on African Americans and black women in particular.
It really did. And if you look at the unemployment levels that black women were subjected to during the economic downturn, it was very significant. So you had huge disparities in terms of people being laid off when you look at black women versus every other category. In addition, blacks were very hard hit in terms of mortgages and losing homes. And one of the things, when you look at the 20-to-1 disparity in terms of wealth accumulation, mm-hmm. the two biggest factors in that, and 20-to-1 is a huge disparity between white and black.
Let me jump in here. Yeah, the average family median income among black Americans is 5% the average median income family wealth among white Americans. Is that right?
In terms of wealth accumulation, not in terms of salary. Salary, there is a big differential as well, but it's not 20-to-1. But in terms of wealth accumulation, mm-hmm. it is. And the two key factors are income, which is a big disparity, and then home ownership. So in terms of, you know, increasing your wealth, if you own your home, generally that is extremely helpful in terms of increasing your wealth. But blacks were hit particularly hard during the mortgage crunch, and many disproportionately lost homes during the financial difficulties.
Were black Americans hit disproportionately with predatory lending practices?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. I talk about in the book in chapters 4 and 5. I talk about that aspect. And blacks were there are a number of actually cases going on now, and a couple have been settled recently with some of your biggest banks where blacks were targeted, were singled out. There's a huge case in Maryland where blacks were targeted and singled out for extending them loans that were, you know, very high in terms of interest rates, and that it would be very difficult for them to maintain payments. And a big lawsuit, a settlement occurred, but it was identified that blacks were targeted. And so in terms of predatory lending, blacks were one of the biggest victims of these predatory lending schemes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Asher in Dallas. Hi, Asher.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thanks for having a wonderful discussion today. A few years ago, I read a book called Slavery by Another Name, which really showed that slavery actually had continued well into the 20th century, well past when we had thought it had ended, through a relationship between organized business and actually the judicial system. The question that I had is I never understood that and had thought of slavery as ending with the Emancipation Proclamation. And the question that I have for the guest today is, when I had read that book, I had thought about what it might mean for us to have reparations and create funds that would help to really attack some of the issues that we're seeing in terms of racial disparities. And wanted to understand more about the notion of reparations and keeping potentially businesses accountable for the acts of slavery by another name, and really the type of reparations that could be really used to help attack some of the real racial disparities that we see in our country today.
Thanks for your call. Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, great question. Two aspects. One is, and it's a great book. I thought it was fantastic. What happened in our country was while slavery was eliminated, what occurred in many southern states during the late in the Reconstruction period and afterwards was blacks were arrested under various laws, such as vagrancy laws if you didn't have a job, and they were subjected to incarceration if they couldn't pay a fine, and then they were loaned out to the state to work while they were incarcerated.
So put onto chain gangs, essentially, as free labor.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And there was a famous prison, Parchman Farm, where many of the blacks were sent. And oftentimes, when their time of service ran out, additional time would be placed on them. So many, and the work was tremendously hard. Many died in various mines and in fields. And this was done by organized business as well as the states. State governments were involved in this, and it was very lucrative for the businesses as well as the states to do. It's well documented in the book that your caller mentioned, as well as a few other books, and it is a travesty, but it is a line of developments that has occurred in the country of racial discrimination and oppression. And the second aspect of the caller's question about what should be done is we clearly need an adequate remedy for these things that were done, for the discrimination that occurred. And unfortunately, that adequate remedy has not been provided. It hasn't been provided for slavery. It hasn't been provided for the harm that was caused by Jim Crow. And it hasn't been provided by the current discrimination that continues. We have not addressed it. And I think it is very important that we do so. There are a couple of states that have provided for educational opportunities to those who were harmed by Jim Crow segregation in education. But I don't know of any states that have provided any remedy for the slavery by another name problem. And I think it will be important for adequate remedies to be provided for individuals that were harmed under these racist practices. I think it's very important to address that issue. And in Ghosts of Jim Crow, in the solutions chapters 6 and 7, I talk about some of those solutions, including a discussion on reparations.
Well, that leads us into a question about inequities in the criminal justice system. There are no laws that say, here are the sentencing rules for white people, here are the sentencing rules for black people, here are the sentencing rules for brown people. And yet we have seen for decades now that that criminal justice is applied in different ways according to race. Can you talk about the reasons for that?
Sure. During Jim Crow, you had laws that specifically mandated unequal treatment in sentencing. So blacks and whites that committed the same crimes would be given different sentences. That was mandated. After Jim Crow ended, if you look at the sentencing that occurred, you had tremendous disparities in sentencing based upon race. Famous case, McCleskey versus Kemp, a 1987 decision by the United States Supreme Court, 5-4 decision, where you had a black defendant, Warren McCleskey, who submitted statistical evidence of a 4-1 disparity in sentencing based upon race, capital sentencing. So we're talking about execution.
Mm-hmm.
4-1 difference. If you're black and your victim was white, you're 4 times as likely to get the death penalty than if you're white and your victim was black. United States Supreme Court, 5 justices said, even if we accept Mr. McCleskey's statistics, our notion of constitutional equality does not prevent this type of discrimination. And you had 4 justices in dissent, including 2 of my favorite justices, Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan. Those four justices in dissent said, what would be so wrong with accepting Mr. McCleskey's statistics and argument? We think the majority of 5 has a fear of too much justice. Now, I can tell you, I never had, I've been afraid of a whole lot of things, but never a fear of too much justice. And so what the problem is that the Supreme Court has not indicated in its decisions that our notion of constitutional equality should prevent these kinds of disparities. So while the court has said the law can no longer mandate the disparities, if in fact these disparities occur through practice or through accident, there's nothing that the court will do about it. And to me, that's a tragedy because it's still quite unfair. It's inconsistent with my notion and what I view as America's notion and commitment to racial equality. It's inconsistent with, you know, our most enduring promise that all are created equal.
Michael Higginbotham is my guest. His book is Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. We'll go back to the phone now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ray on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ray.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really do appreciate our guest today coming from a legal perspective. However, I have seen him on some other shows and from the conversation today. The topic in which he addresses, and I think he does a really good job at doing so, really is an interdisciplinary problem, meaning we have a both legal and political and sociological institutions and patterns creating psychological harm. I grew up as a young African American in the rural South in Arkansas in the 80s and 90s, so not that long ago. And schools there did not integrate into the mid-70s. And so when I began school in the mid-80s, my school had only been integrated about 10 years. And there was almost a tangible ethos of racism and bias still existing in those schools. I'd like for our guest to address the idea, Peggy McIntosh's idea of white privilege, that sometimes it is not spoken, not direct, but there are privileges and biases depending on your racial context.
Yeah. Thanks for your call.
I think it's a very important question, and I would agree that my background is in the law, and that's what the book is focused in on. And so I don't want to practice medicine without a license, so I'm going to stay away from the psychological aspect, although I do think that the Supreme Court has noted it. For me, and the book talks about the white privilege aspect, for me, blacks can't really do much about the notion of white privilege. It's up to whites to stop white privilege in our society. And I know my own experiences have been that, when white people stand up against racism by other whites, when white people stand up, things get done. Race discrimination by whites can be prevented. And so for me, it's so important in dealing with white privilege to have whites in our society say, this is wrong. This is inconsistent with our notion of equality. And so for me, everybody has a role to play. But when you talk about white privilege, it's whites themselves that really have to, I think, deal with that. And, there's books that document, what we're talking about when we talk about white privilege. But I think, Richard Pryor the famous comedian, used to talk about, getting stopped by the police. And, he would see the blacks put in chokeholds and treated one way and the whites treated another way. And Colbert, comedian also, has a character, a blind black fellow, who thinks he's white because of the way he's treated by the police when they stop him and talk to him. They treat him with a great deal of respect. So, I mean, we joke about these things, but there clearly is aspects of white privilege that exist, and people just seem to take it for granted.
White people take it for granted.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that needs to be dealt with by whites in our society. I don't think that blacks can do much about that. Now, blacks have a role to play, of course, in making sure that black folks continue to work hard, continue to take advantage of legitimate vehicles for upward mobility, value education, and other legitimate vehicles. So there's a role to play for everyone in our society in eliminating this racial model. But I think whites have to deal with the white privilege aspect. And I think clearly they can do that, and they can make a big difference in that.
There are some people who say, look, it's not so much white privilege as it's an issue of social class. And I want to talk, you share your own story just briefly in the book. You were raised in a family with some privilege. You had a spectacular education. Your parents were educated. And yet you have not gone through your life without experiencing pretty severe racism at particular times.
Yes, and that's really, I think, some of my motivation, personal motivation for writing the book. I grew up in I was a beneficiary of the civil rights movement. Grew up in some very nice neighborhoods, where schools, where social activities were supposed to be free of racism. We were supposed to be beyond that, and unfortunately, my experience was, despite the implementation of anti-discrimination laws and affirmative action in our society, my experience was in terms of being tracked, not for the elite colleges. I was stopped by the police. I described an incident of smiling while black. You know, we talk about how people, get stopped for driving while black or for walking while black. Mm-hmm. And I got hassled by the Los Angeles police for smiling while black. And so my experience of race discrimination was a surprise to me, because I thought that at least in some neighborhoods in our society, we had gotten beyond that. And unfortunately, racism is everywhere, whether you are wealthy black, middle-class black, or impoverished black. Racism impacts you in this society. And I know, John Johnson wrote a book, The Richest Black Man in America, a decade or two ago. He wrote a book about his experiences with racism, even in the later years of his life, being followed around stores. You know, he's worth $2 billion, and he's being followed around stores because he's black and people think he's going to shoplift.
My guest is F. Michael Higginbotham. His new book is called Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. We'll be back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with F. Michael Higginbotham. He's Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and author of the new book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Lindsay on the line in Dallas. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. I am really glad to hear that your guest book has chapters that focus on solutions, and that's actually what my question was about. Our school system right now doesn't serve students who don't have a lot of support at home, and that seems to disproportionately affect students of color. So I wondered what ideas you might have for changing our school system so that it can address the needs of those students.
Well, I think it's very important to help students in particular need. And so one of my main suggestions is to equalize the funding in our public schools, to eliminate this disparate funding based upon economic status. And once that is done, to me, many of these institutions where the students are impoverished and have particular needs that are not addressed at home, more money will be available to help those students. So that's one of my suggestions. I have I have three basic areas of solution. And the first thing that needs to be done is we need to recognize we have a problem. And unfortunately, too many people today, I think, say that, you know, we're in a post-racial society and we really don't need to address any issues along racial and equity lines. So one, we got to recognize we have a problem. Once we do that, then I think we need to empower various communities, and also we need to have some self-help in various communities. And part of that empowerment would be equal funding for education. Another way to also empower these communities is to have an American Jobs Act. You know, provide training for folks so that they can get jobs or get better jobs. And I think when we do the education and the job component, that's going to make a huge difference for giving people an opportunity to improve themselves.
So in this book, Michael, you focus primarily on the black-white divide, and heaven knows you could fill an entire library of volumes just covering that subject. But I wonder how comparable you think the effects of persistent racism are on other non-white communities in the United States.
I think that non-white communities share a similar negative impact. And I really grappled with whether I wanted to include additional racial groups in the book, and quite frankly, it just got to be way too much. I think we need to have books written about Latinos, American Indians, Asian Americans, because I think their plight, while it bears similarities, particularly in terms of how the law viewed these groups, and whether or not the law treated them as inferior. So I think there's tremendous similarities there, but there's also very unique experiences, which I didn't feel I could adequately address, but I do feel that the book would be very valuable to write about other racial minority groups as well. So there's similarities, and I think if you look at Ghosts of Jim Crow, to look at the similarities between black and Latino, black and American Indian, black and Asian American, there's tremendous similarities, particularly during the Jim Crow days. When blacks were separated out, when they were the majority in a particular area, but also Asian Americans were separated out in California and other areas where they were the majority racial minority group in the area. And Latinos in the Southwest were treated the same way. So segregation applied to all of these groups, and the justification for segregating them was the same. They are different. They are inferior. And so to me, there's a tremendous similarity there in why these groups were treated the way they were treated, but very unique stories that need to be told.
And I want to talk just for a minute about the discomfort we still have in this country talking about issues of race with people who are of other races. To the extent that Americans understand that it is wrong to be a racist today, do you think white Americans sort of pat themselves on the back if they are not being actively racist and then assume that their responsibility to fix the problem ends there?
I think that we really all have a duty. We all have an obligation as American citizens to try and contribute to creating equality in this society. I think if we just sit back and say, look, we're not racist, while other people may be, that's not our problem, we can't do that. I look at, you know, what happened in Boston the other day with the bombing, and I looked at how Americans of all races and ethnicities rushed to assist individuals who were harmed. And to me, that's what we also need to do with the racism problem, because racism harms all Americans as well. And we all need to have that same unifying feeling, unifying approach when we're trying to address the racial disparities that continue to exist.
Back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Clint in McKinney. Hi, Clint.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. And
sure.
Thank you for having this conversation. I think it's important. I just really wanted to pose a scenario that actually recently occurred to me and get your guest's opinion, and then, if you don't mind, share with you what steps I took and get your opinion on that as well. So recently I was tasked with conducting an interview for a candidate, and the hiring manager wasn't able to make it in person. So she was on the call via teleconference. I conducted the interview shortly after the interview. One of the first questions I was asked by her and a team of people on the call was what ethnicity the person was that I interviewed. And I'd like to hear your guest comments on what steps or actions you think should be taken in that situation. And then, like I said,
well, let's get it out of the way. Tell us what you did, and then we'll get comments from Michael. Thanks.
Sure. So I held a meeting with the hiring manager and let her know that, I refused to answer the question, and I said that I didn't think it was an appropriate question to ask. Subsequently, I held a meeting with her and her supervisor and let her know that, you know, if that question came through, I was comfortable conducting the interview, but wouldn't be addressing or answering those questions.
What do you think about that, Michael?
Yeah, this raises, of course, a really tough problem in our society today. It deals with the anti-discrimination aspects that we wish to embrace, that people should not be discriminated against on the basis of race in school admission, employment applications, and so forth. But also, we want to create a diverse society. We value diversity in this society. We value inclusiveness. And so the tricky aspect that the caller's question raises is how do we, in a society with a history of racial discrimination and exclusion, how do we treat everyone with protection against discrimination, but at the same time try to be inclusive so that we value our racial diversity? It's really a tough thing. The Supreme Court, of course, you got the Super Bowl of civil rights going on this year with affirmative action case from Texas, from Michigan, as well as a voting rights case from Alabama and a gay rights case from California. It is huge issues that the court is deciding, and those issues go to the caller's question. How do we, in a society with a history of racial inequity, how do we create a society where we no longer have to consider race as a factor in our determinations? It's something that I think we all want to get to, but the question is how we get there. And today, I think we have to be able to identify individuals on the basis of race so we can make sure of two things. One, that we're not discriminating in the sense of looking at statistics as to whether people get hired or not. And two, that we're inclusive in our hiring practices, that we value the diversity in our society, whether it be race, whether it be religion, whether it be ethnicity, whether it be geographic or other factors.
We have an email here from Greg in Frisco who talks about the importance of providing context for the phrase white privilege. Greg writes, as an African American, I've had this conversation with many friends over the years, and if you ask many whites, they vehemently deny believing any superiority exists. To have meaningful dialogue, you have to provide everyday examples beyond high-level legal occurrences. For example, the fact that one must look and speak and act a certain way at executive-level corporate America provides an undue advantage to whites. Blacks are typically required to alter manners of speech, dress, and appearance more in conformance with the mainstream white culture to attain certain credibility. This provides a distinct advantage to the majority. We actually need a new name to replace racism, one that doesn't invoke memories of lunch counters, but rather the need to adapt to this standardism. What do you think about that, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I look at, you know, I look at the first presidential election Obama was running. And I look at how opponents of Obama attempted to portray him as the other, you know, as growing up in Hawaii, as going to schools in Indonesia and other places, as not being born in America, and the characterization of him as the other, so that the norm is white America. That's the norm. To me, that was wrong, because America stands for much more than that. And so I think the question basically about white privilege and the norm, and that whites aren't recognizing the privilege that may exist. You just look in the newspaper, for examples, a lot of times you have a description of a person and race is left off. But when that person is a minority, race is added so that the norm is white and that the exception has to be identified. That is not what America is all about. And so there is a privilege in being viewed as the norm, not the exception, not the unusual. And I think that's something that people need to focus in on. But there are specific examples in the book about white privilege and what that means in our society today.
What role can the law play in changing attitudes, and what are the limitations of our ability to sort of legislate unbiased senses of our neighbors of different races?
I mean, I think the law is so important. I really think that we can change hearts and minds in this country. The law, to me, is one of the main bases for how individuals think about certain issues. If you look at interracial marriage today, they say 80% of Americans see nothing wrong with interracial marriage today. In 1967, when the Supreme Court decided Loving Virginia, that was reversed. 80% opposed interracial marriage. And so what transpired between 67 and today? A Supreme Court decision which said it's illegitimate to prohibit interracial marriage, I think had a lot to do with how people think about this notion. And so to me, you can change hearts and minds by changing the laws, because that will help to impact how people think. It's the same sort of phenomenon that occurs when Michael Jordan bites into a Big Mac, and everybody says, oh, gee, I want to run out, you know, and eat a Big Mac. The Supreme Court is the Michael Jordan of government. Mm-hmm. And so the Supreme Court has a tremendous impact on what people think is right and wrong.
Do you think that young people are looking to the courts and the law in the same way that people who maybe have a few more decades of life experience under their belts do?
I hope that all of us, no matter, you know, what our age, I hope that all of us have a respect for the rule of law. I think one of the things that makes America such a great country is that we respect the rule of law. You know, we respect our Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has no enforcement power whatsoever. But when the Supreme Court makes a ruling, people follow it. They respect that. And so I think it's important for all folks, irrespective of age, to look at the court, to look at our democratic institutions, and to value them.
F. Michael Higginbotham is Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore and author of the new book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Michael, it's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to contribute, and, you know, it's all about thinking.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think or email us at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.